All right, the committee will come to order. Thank you, folks, for once again braving the early hours to be here. Today, we're going to have a discussion on state assessments. As you recall, last time we met, we talked about our standards. And this will really, members, be kind of the last big informational hearing. We're going to start hearing bills next week. We're not quite sure what's teeing up yet, but we think some early childhood bills early on, so we can hopefully move those along to Chairperson Slawick's committee for their further consideration. As you folks who have been around here a little while know, things are going to pick up pretty quickly here in a very short period of time. Members, I want to refer you to, actually, we do have a quorum, and we should probably take care of a little bit of business. I need a approval of the February 6th minutes. Anyone game? Yes, Representative Gutwald?
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Gutwald moves approval of the February 6th minutes. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is approved. The minutes are approved. Okay, members, I refer you to your packet. There's several items in the packet. We're going to do today's discussion in three parts. A very quick first part will be just to have a reference from our House research person on the information in your packets. Next, we're going to hear from Mr. David Heistad and Mr. Ballo. Is he also with you?
Yeah.
Okay, so Dr. Heistad, Dr. Ballo, I hope I said that right. We'll get it right later. And then later on, we're going to hear from Becky Schroeder and Rick Spicuzza. So at this point, and again, you know, last Tuesday when we met, you know, we had this little guide that we had inserted. I'm not sure if it's in your packet today, but I brought mine. And in it, we just you know, try to pose some very broad questions for us to consider as we engage with our testifiers today. The first among those questions are things like, how is state testing used as an accountability measure by teachers, by parents, by students, districts, and the state? What can or can't testing do? What's the difference between formative and summative tests? I'm sure that'll be a very brief discussion, right? What are value-added models? How well aligned are standards and assessments in our state? And then later on, when we hear from district level folks, what have school districts experienced in implementing the state assessments? So what's the real life experience that's going on out there in our districts in regards to the assessments? And so members, if you just sort of keep those in mind as sort of broad areas or just the beginning, you know, set of questions for us to guide our discussions today. So with that, I'm going to ask Dr. David Heistad, Director of Research Evaluation and Assessment of Minneapolis Public Schools, to introduce himself and to begin his testimony. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Heistad. I'm the Executive Director.
You know what? I'm sorry. It's because it's an 8 o'clock morning meeting. I apologize. I did have an order to this, and, you know, what I want to do, I apologize, Dr. Heistad, is to have Lisa Larson go through the information in our packet very briefly, and then we'll jump to you. I apologize for jumping quickly. Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, members, there are three documents in there that House Research prepared. One has to do with an overview of the federal and state testing requirements that apply to K-12 public school students. These would include a description of the test mandated by Title I, the test mandated as a result of Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment, the basic skills tests, which are in the process of being transformed, and also NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. I mention NAEP specifically because one of the other documents you have has to do with state's analysis of student performance under No Child Left Behind. And you may well be aware that across, were it not for NAEP, cross-state comparisons of student performance on test to determine adequate yearly progress would be impossible because every state sets its own standards. In addition, you have a document on adequate yearly progress under No Child Left Behind that describes how Minnesota determines adequate yearly progress. And those are the three House research documents that you have related to testing and assessing the results of that testing.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. So basically, the NAEP will allow us to do sort of a state-to-state comparison across the states. Thank you. Dr. Heistad, we'll try it again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Heistad. I'm the Executive Director of Research, Evaluation, and Assessment in Minneapolis Public Schools. I've held that position for the last 7 years, and before that I was an evaluator for special education services in Minneapolis schools. I am pleased to be here to answer your questions. I don't have a long prepared statement. I did put together a PowerPoint last night that has a couple of main points that I'd like to go through, but I basically like to be available for questions. The whole area of assessment is very, very complex. There's so many different types of assessment for different purposes, and what I've defined assessment to be is a sample of behavior, and assessment is taking place all the time in classrooms across the state in very informal ways and very formal ways. So it varies from just a simple collection of tasks, writing samples, journals, things in the classroom that happen every day, to the very formal tests that we're talking about. And so when you get to talking about standardized tests, then there's certain types of standards that you have to meet with your assessment for use for high-stakes purposes. And that's mainly what I'm going to talk about today, are those high-stakes tests where you're making critical decisions about the lives of children or schools or districts or states. You know, and those tests have to meet guidelines of technical adequacy. They have to be highly reliable. They have to measure what they say they measure, and they have to be used appropriately. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about is the way we use information and how we could maybe use that information more appropriately. The high-stakes tests in Minneapolis and throughout Minnesota really started with the basic standards tests, which you're most likely quite familiar with. And the basic standards tests are really a good example of a test for a specific purpose, and that being certifying that students have the basic skills and information, knowledge necessary to graduate. And many states throughout the country have had graduation tests, and I think our assessment system in Minnesota has been well designed. All of the items that are chosen for the basic standards tests are selected to be kind of at that real minimum essentials for survival after high school, and that it's been carefully designed and has measured considerable progress in Minnesota. We've seen the passing rates for reading especially climb dramatically from the time the tests were initiated. So I think they've really met their purpose. And as was mentioned earlier, the graduation tests are going through a revision process right now. The critical question is, where do you set the passing rates? And so the Minnesota Basic Standards Tests have been set at a level in mathematics that was pre-algebra. So our previous test went up to algebra but didn't include algebra. Now the new graduation tests are going to assume mastery of at least Algebra 1 type material to graduate from high school. So that's going to be a challenge as we look at all of the instruction in mathematics in Minnesota from pre-K all the way up through grade 12 to get students ready to pass these more difficult tests. The students will have multiple opportunities to take the new grad test, just like they have with the basic standards test. But one challenge is that instead of giving these assessments in eighth grade, the assessments will start showing up this year. Ninth grade writing will be assessed. Next year, 10th grade reading will be assessed. And 11th grade, the mathematics will be assessed. And we know that math test is going to be much more difficult. Well, the students are going to have less opportunities to take that mathematics test to graduate. And one of my fears is that we're going to have larger numbers of students who are going to be fifth and sixth year graduates in the state because of the difficulty of that test. And that was something that I thought I would bring up. The other thing that hasn't been worked out entirely are the exemptions and modifications to make the test fair for English language learners and special education students. And I know the department is working on that. But we want to make sure that students brand new to the country aren't penalized because of their language deficits. We also want to make sure that the individual education program, the IEP, really will dictate how special education students are best assessed. We know that depending on the severity of the disability, certain adaptations really need to be made for students in special education.
Dr. Heistad, I'm going to interrupt you for a second because I really do want this to be, and I think you do too, an exchange here. Representative Heigerich, I believe, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that key piece there, the exemption, is Minnesota pretty much in compliance with what the other states are doing in that area with the ELL?
Dr. Heistad.
The exemption processes do differ from state to state. The Minnesota comprehensive assessments that I'm going to talk about in a little while are dictated by the state No Child Left Behind Act, and all states must comply with the act in the same way. We have some discretion at the states in how we look at exemptions and adaptations for the graduation test. And I think in some states they may translate the test, and for the mathematics test, to have a script that teachers could read or to have some kind of an oral administration of the test. Even the math test is so heavily loaded with language that it tends to be very difficult for students that don't speak English as their primary home language.
Representative Heiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, in regards to the funding mechanism, the way we interpret the test on this level, has it in any way caused a funding lax in comparison with some of the other states, being that they're a little bit more easygoing in these areas and we're probably a little bit tougher? Has that in any way, the way we interpret our test in this area, affected the funding mechanism?
Dr. Heistad.
As far as I know, there aren't funding consequences tied to the Minnesota Basic Standards Test. We do need to provide education for students who have yet to pass the test, and in Minneapolis we have students in their 20s that are still working on passing the basic standards test. Now those students tend to come to their high school that they're hoping to graduate from until they're about 21, and after that point the adult basic education program picks up those students, and students have an option to take the alternative GED or the MBST. And I'm hopeful that that will be the same sort of situation when we get to the new grad test, that will offer opportunities for students to improve their skills and then pass these tests.
And Dr. Heistad, the relationship between those alternative forms of attaining a diploma, the relationship between those and the level set within our graduation standards, what's the relationship between those?
I don't believe there have been scientific studies of the linking the difficulty level, but from anecdotal evidence, I've heard that the Minnesota Basic Standards Test is a little bit easier than the GED test, and that students are opting to take the basic standards test instead. Now, if it's true that the standards are going to be raised for the new graduation test, that may turn out to be the opposite. The new grad test may be more difficult than the GED. It's hard to tell, but it would be nice to encourage research to see not only the difficulty level, but how much overlap there is in terms of content and addressing the standards.
Dr. Heist, I believe we have a question from Senator Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Heist, you made a comment that you see that in the future that more fifth and sixth year high school students are coming back for passing the test to pass the test to graduate. Do you have any statistics that indicate how many of those students that have not passed the grad standard test are coming back and how many are not coming back?
Dr. Heistad.
Thank you for that question. We do have a considerable number of students that need a fifth and possibly sixth year. We have students that would have passed if they the only criteria were credits earned. They only have the basic standards test. We have students that have both credits and BSD shortages, and then those that are simply short on credits. And we do keep detailed records on that. We find that primarily the students that need extra time are English language learners and special education students, but not exclusively. Students in poverty are highly overrepresented in that group as well. Mm-hmm. Some students, the students that are short on credits will continue in the main high school or in an alternatives school. Some students more or less stop their education process and only come back to take the test. And I haven't analyzed to see how successful those students are versus those that are in ABE programs or other alternative situations. But it's a concern that I thought I'd mention as we ratchet up the difficulty of the grad test that we may need to provide more, accelerated learning opportunities for those students.
Thank you. Dr. Heister, Representative Tilbury has a question for you.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Heister, I do have a question. How many times could a student take a specific test? Like when you had mentioned that mm-hmm. they had to complete this test and it could be as of age 21, how many times do you think it takes for a student that is in that situation
mm-hmm.
would be taking that test?
Mr. Chairman, the students have opportunities to retake the test in high school twice a year. There's a summer opportunity, and there's the main opportunity that takes place in the winter. In their senior year, they have a third opportunity in April if they haven't passed the test. After that, then students tend to come back once or twice a year to take the test. There are students that do drop out who don't continue on taking the test. However, our dropout rates, and one might predict that dropout rates would have increased as a consequence of the basic standards test, but our dropout rates in Minneapolis have continued to improve every year since the basic standards test. So we haven't seen an increase in dropouts, but there are students that do give up, in a sense, if they don't have either the credits or the basic standards test in place. And I could provide those data on Minneapolis dropouts if needed.
Thank you. Dr. Heistad, Representative Wardlaw has a question for you, and then after that we'll just continue with your presentation.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wardlaw.
I've got a question. Now that they're embedding the basic standards test in the MCAs, I wonder how that's going to work when students come back after in their fifth and sixth year to take that test. Do they just take that portion of the MCA over, or how does that work?
Excellent question.
Dr. Heisen.
Mr. Chairman, Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments has a large range of difficulty of items from below the standard all the way to way above the standard, the graduation proportion will be only a subset of those items. And then if a student doesn't hit the criteria for the grad test proficiency, they will retake only those items. And I think the department has plans to try to put those assessments on computer and make them available possibly more flexibly and possibly more often than currently, but it would be only those items that are right at the proficiency level, considered to be the grad items, that they would retake. The MCAs, the entire MCA will have its high standards set for No Child Left Behind, and there will be a second cut score that will be just for the grad items, and that will be a bit lower than our high standard.
Representative Wardlow, and we note that Dr. Mattson is here, and perhaps later on we might want to have him come up and expound a little bit more on that. Dr. Heisman, please proceed.
I only have a couple of slides on the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments, the MCA2s. As mentioned, they are the No Child Left Behind accountability tools. These tests are given in grades 3 through 8 in reading and math. There's a 10th grade reading and 11th grade math test. And the purpose is really here to see increase in percentage of students that are at the proficiency level. And you've heard about the state standards and how the assessments are directly linked to those state standards. And our challenge is to have all students proficient in those standards by the time that they move on to post-graduation activities. Schools, under No Child Left Behind, schools that fail to meet pre-specified benchmarks, and the goal is by 2014, 100% of students in the state will be proficient on these tests. The schools that don't hit those pre-specified targets have consequences as specified explicitly in the federal law, and those consequences tend to be pretty punitive or negative kinds of consequences, like getting the name of the school in the paper as an underperforming school, notification of parents that the school is not making adequate progress, and the students may be transferred to a school that is not on the list, and then restructuring the school. A school has a year to plan to restructure, and then in the fifth year, failing to meet the targets, they actually can press start the school, replace the principal, replace all the faculty, completely restructure the curriculum, any or all of the above. So those are seen as very negative consequences to teachers and principals, and there's a lot of fear and anxiety in the schools about those consequences. There's one potential positive consequence. If you've been on the list of not making adequate progress for 3 years in a row, then you can offer supplemental services. So a portion of the Title I funds are set aside for after school or before school tutoring programs. These programs can be provided for the district by the district if the district is not on the list of not making adequate progress. But if the district is on that list, then you have to use outside vendors. The problem, at least in Minneapolis, is we have yet to find strong evidence that those after-school programs are working very well. We've done an analysis. I'll be doing another one this year that showed that students that didn't go to the tutoring programs actually did as well as the students that did. So our challenge is to find very successful after-school, before-school programs that either offered by the district or by outside vendors that are really making a difference. That's a whole other discussion why potentially this isn't happening, but we need to work on the quality, and it is the responsibility of the state to evaluate the success of these after-school programs.
Dr. Heister, I believe Representative Heingarten has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still caught up with the thought earlier. In regards to the state of Minnesota, in compliance, especially with, and I've always brought this up, the students that are up to moving about a lot,
mm-hmm.
Okay, the highly mobile student, okay. Yes. Are other states doing the same thing as we are? Do they, my understanding is some states allow for a longer assimilation period, a longer period of being there before they're put into the test. I know that they're, I was listening to WCCO last week, we had the guy from the state of Minnesota, No Child Left Behind. So in the state of Minnesota, it's kind of the overseer, but he was talking about differences. And there are differences out there. I'm wondering, and that is an issue that I know we're going to discuss perhaps in education finance, Representative Grant, with the LEP. The five-year window, I think we have, we're trying to change into seven, and it's an issue Representative Dabney's coming here within his district. But it's something that I put him right on the hot. I love it. But anyways,
good morning.
But it is an issue. And could you just give me where we're at with the other states and what they may be doing differently there?
Dr.
Heister.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the variability is there from state to state. I don't know where Minnesota ranks in terms of its recognition of how long it takes to really be competent in the first language. I know that there are issues about when you take the first assessment. The feds are pretty tight on that. We have only 1 year, and the students have to take the MCAs. It's a very difficult mm-hmm. test. Last year we were approved to use the T-test, which is a scaffolded assessment where the English language learners would take a very simple set of items to start with. You might be reading off of signs or things in the classroom, and then gradually you move up to grade level passages. But that test was found to be unacceptable to the feds, so mm-hmm. we're back to having mm-hmm. to give the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment. The MBSC we have control over in terms of how many years. The funding issues, I think, are primarily around how many years do you expect it to take a student to be proficient mm-hmm. in the language, and currently the funding is tied to a five-year limit. And there are many students that aren't proficient after 5 years, especially if they come in like in sixth or seventh grade, middle school. It's a lot easier for students to acquire language in preschool and kindergarten than it is in middle school or high school, Sudbury's. I'm very pleased that you as a body are looking at that question, because it has a big impact upon adequacy of funding for English language learners.
Thank you. Excellent question, Representative Heigerfman. Please proceed, Dr. Heisted.
My point here on the punitive consequences is that I think that Minnesota could take a different tact. We have to do No Child Left Behind the way that is specified in law, but there's nothing that says Minnesota can't go over and above the No Child Left Behind requirements and actually provide some positive incentives to schools. And my work in the last 10 years has been around identifying schools and groups of teachers that are making exceptional difference with students in their classroom. And rather than punishing schools, which tends not to change behavior in the positive direction, schools should be rewarded for narrowing the achievement gaps. And in Minneapolis, we use a multiple measure system where we reward growth towards the standards as well as getting over the bar. So we have what we call value-added indicators or gain indicators, where it's the amount of difference in reading and math performance from the time you have the student in the fall to the time they're tested in the spring that you're held accountable for. You're not accountable for the fact that a large group of immigrant students moved into your school and all of a sudden the average test scores go down. And No Child Left Behind does that, where it's last year's third graders against this year's third graders. If you have a population shift in your school, you're automatically on the AYP list because the average test scores go down. But if that same school could be showing tremendous growth for the students that they have. So we have an opportunity, I think, to use our state tests. We have all students tested this year and last year. We can start looking at what is the typical growth and then which schools, which groups of teachers are showing greater progress. And we could break that out so we could find out which schools in outstate Minnesota are making a great difference with Hispanic students. We could find out which students are having the greatest impact with poverty in suburbs, in inner city, and outstate. So I think we have an opportunity to revamp the STAR system, which largely rewards status still, and use our growth information to find schools that are beating the odds. And The current star system, the easiest way to get 5 stars on the system is really to have no diversity in your school at all. If you have all middle-class white students who are performing at the rate that middle-class white students usually perform, then you'll probably get 5 stars. But what we have an opportunity to do is reward those schools that they're making great progress, no matter what the demographics of their students. I guess I'm being redundant here. So I think to have that, you do have to have a system that monitors the same students across time. And the state is working on that. You've already put legislation in requiring value-added assessment. So it would be that next step of actually acknowledging these schools, providing some incentives, and make it fair to all schools that they have an opportunity to earn rewards, to be acknowledged based on how much learning takes place, what the rate of growth is, not simply the performance on the standards. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on local assessments. I think my colleagues are coming. But in general, local assessments have somewhat different purposes. The purposes that aren't being met by the state assessment are picked up by the local assessment. State assessments haven't measured growth very well. So most of the districts in Minnesota that I work with, the colleagues in the metro area using something called the NALT or the CALT or the ALT or the WALT. They're all achievement level tests. Now it's called the MAP if you have a good computer system. They all measure growth. They were designed to measure growth. Students take assessments at their own instructional level, and then they're very good for accountability and for program evaluation. You can measure individual progress as well as group progress. So the state assessment wasn't designed to that. Even using the value added that we have, it's more at a group level that we can be confident that the gain scores would be technically adequate. But these other assessments are to drive instruction. And we have kindergarten and first grade assessments in Minneapolis, so that we don't wait till third grade to find out that students haven't met the standards. So I encourage all districts in the state to have these local assessments to fill in the gaps where the state doesn't have assessments. And I think most districts are doing that. And so I'm going to end my presentation by just indicating what I would have shown to the committee in terms of a videotape. Because of the time, I'm not going to actually show it, but we have kindergarten teachers that are doing an exceptional job where we've used the data in the way that I was describing to find the groups of teachers that are making the greatest difference. Then we go out and videotape those teachers, and they become models for other teachers, and it's a very positive way to recognize. And a lot of these teachers were teaching in high poverty schools with very diverse learners. The videotapes are available online, and I gave you a link to that if you're interested in looking at it. But I think we could do the same thing with our state accountability system. So find those schools that are doing a great job. Have the media and the public focus some attention on the great teaching that's going on, as well as the challenges. And it's a really good way then to replicate successful programs, is to actually see your own teachers in your own state making a difference with diverse students. So that's what I'm recommending, and in the limited time that we have left, I can take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Heistad, and I agree with you in terms of that, your last point about the public really being engaged in this. It seems to me that, you know, transparency in terms of our standards and assessments is a key thing for us to be working on. In the end, you know, our public school system, excuse me, is ultimately dependent on the confidence that the public has in the work there. So, point well taken. I look forward to us finding creative ways to engage the public more in this manner. There are a number of questions we have from members, and I'll begin with Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Dr. Heist said you expressed some concerns about supplemental services, and I'm wondering how much money in Minneapolis is spent on those services, and have you, since you expressed some concerns about how effective they are, have you thought about any alternative programs that might be more effective?
Dr. Heist.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Posh. I do think that the idea of providing supplemental services is... it's something that we need to improve upon. And I think there may be some things that need to happen with the current supplemental services to make them effective. I don't think there's very good communication between regular teachers and after-school teachers, at least in the programs that I've seen. I don't think they're using the assessment information from the regular classroom to know where to start with students. Some of the programs are not intense enough and don't focus in on the skills in reading and math that really need to be developed. But I think we need to discover successful programs for extending the school day. And I think looking at different models of extending the time, I think, is crucial. Right now, there's not a great incentive for districts to participate in this collaboration between the outside vendors and the local assessments. It's part of their money that has to be frozen, that they can't use within the district, that's then sent out to outside vendors. And especially if they're not seeing results, it's not enthusiasm around that program. I think we need to look at the whole area. It's not just the extension of time, though. It's how you use that time. And I think the programs that are most effective are those that are getting students engaged in exciting activities and providing continuous feedback and really are motivating students to want to come. Attendance is a very big problem at most of these after-school programs. And so there are a lot of issues we need to work on. And I'd like the districts to be able to work together with the state to try to find programs that are being successful so we can replicate those programs.
So, Dr. Heise, just to be clear, for me, at this point, we don't have a centralized way, i.e., I would imagine the Department of Ed would be the centralized place. We don't have a real centralized way and framework to be able to assess quality levels of supplemental service providers. Is that...
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct. I think the department staff doesn't have enough resources to do that work. The assessments, just developing and maintaining the assessment system is a huge job. And so right now, they're very interested in collecting information from the studies we've done. They're very cooperative, but I don't believe... And my colleague Dirk could challenge this, but I don't think they have the resources to do it.
Okay, thank you. Is that okay, Representative Gladley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Heistad, could you? A lot of districts are asking to have one of those acronyms up there, the formative assessments, be the standard, like Idaho is apparently being allowed to do. For adequate yearly progress for No Child Left Behind. Could you critique that for us, in your opinion?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greiling, the challenge with using these assessments for state accountability is that the feds are very restrictive in the types of tests that they will accept. And I was one of those district representatives that wanted the state to consider using the Northwest Evaluation Levels test as a state test because it was so successful for us in monitoring growth. It has a very good scale and so many districts were using it. However, it became apparent in feedback from the feds that they wouldn't allow a levels test that actually measured student performance at the student's level of mastery, that you had to give the same grade level assessment to all students. And there was question of whether the feds would allow not having open-ended questions or constructed response that at that time Northwest Evaluation didn't have. One could work with a company like NWA to create assessments that would meet the standards, and Idaho did, I believe, do that. The value is that the scale is there so you can measure value added without having to create a new scale. And I know the department is working on a scale for the MCAs that could be used for growth. But I do think, had we made that decision initially, it might have been a little smoother right now for us when we're wanting to produce value-added information. Many of the districts disagree with me that it should be the state test because they love their own assessment system and they really think the delays are too great in getting the assessment information back and that doing it statewide might be difficult with all the computer capacity issues that we have. I have an open mind about this. I think we should make our assessments the best that they can be. They're very useful for accountability. They could be even more useful in measuring growth. And whatever assessments that we choose to develop and use, we need to make sure that the teachers find them useful for instruction.
Dr. Heistad, we're hearing some indications that as the feds deliberate the reauthorization of NCLB, that adding flexibility to the states in this regard in terms of these types of tests, formative in nature, that's very much on the table. So things might happen quickly this year. It would be really smart for us, it seems to me, to be well positioned in the event that happens. Representative Gutwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Heistad, and I'm wondering if you could comment, perhaps other testifiers as well, as we talk about local assessments and trying to monitor students' progress locally, we also have been talking a good deal about how we tie to national and international standards because of the global economy that our students are competing in. Could you comment perhaps on that aspect of this these tests?
Dr. Heistad.
Mr. Chairman, the international assessments that Minnesota participates in is a real opportunity for us to show that we are competitive internationally. The third international math assessment, the TIMSS assessment, is a good example where the state has participated and oversampled so that we could get information at a state level. And we do very well in math compared to international competitors. And so I would encourage the state to continue to participate in those types of assessments. The NAEP, which was mentioned earlier, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, gives us an opportunity to see how we're doing versus other states. And we are doing very well compared to other states in terms of the overall level of performance. Well, the gaps are very large. And one of the things we talked about at another committee hearing was that our white American students are doing so much better than most states in the country. African American students are doing about the same as other students in the country, and therefore we have huge gaps, but even white students have gaps to the standards, the highest international standards. So all groups of students need to have challenging assessments and ways that we can be measuring against international standards. I do think that when one is working with the No Child Left Behind, which is so prescriptive and so punitive, that if we set our state standards for that purpose too high, we may end up punishing schools when we really don't mean to do that. And I'm concerned that with the 11th grade math standard set so high, it's set, I believe, above the NAEP standard and probably above the TIMSS standard in terms of international standards, so that we may have some difficulty with the numbers of schools that are considered to be not making adequate progress there.
Thank you. Members, there are a couple other members that have questions, but I also want to honor the fact that we have three other testifiers. And so if you can hold your questions until we hear that testimony, I would greatly appreciate it. Thank you, Dr. Heistad, and stick around because maybe there will be questions for you toward the end here.
Thank you.
We have Dr. Christopher, I hope I pronounced this right, Balo. Balo, wow, I did all right, from our Stillwater area schools. Following Dr. Balo, we'll have Becky Schroeder and Dr. Rick Spicusa, That's it, spikutsa, if you do it according to the old world. And we have about 40 minutes or so. Let's just watch our time, members. But please, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Chris Balo. I'm the Assessment and Evaluation Coordinator in Stillwater. This is my first year in the position. But for the previous 22 years, I've been a school psychologist in Stillwater and other states, working with students with emotional and behavioral disorders and students with learning disabilities. So I sort of come from the special ed framework historically, but now I'm in a new position this year. My job this morning is to cover a little bit more in depth of what Dr. Heistad talked about, really kind of assessment 101, and how we in a typical Minnesota district look at assessment. And we really look at three levels of analysis within assessment models. We look at the classroom level. We look at the district level and the state level. I'm going to talk about all the kinds of assessments and activities that we undertake across these three levels. We have an assumption, in Stillwater at least, that at all levels the state standards are embedded and are referenced in all the assessments that we conduct, even down to the classroom level. And I'll say more about that. I also want to point out that it's our belief that the most authentic assessments occur in the classroom. And what I mean by authentic are those assessments that inform instruction in a time, within a short time frame, moment to moment for the teacher in terms of what type of curriculum instruction needs to take place. And when you look at state level assessments, they're low in authenticity. Oftentimes these tests are given in the early spring, April in our case, and actually there's 2 months of learning that's going to take place after that when school ends in June, and the results don't come back until for this year, mid-November. So not very authentic in terms of our assessments. A couple core principles that we believe that all assessments should have are that all assessments need to be valid and reliable. They measure what they purport to measure. Their scores are reliable, there's not a lot of error in the measurement. That the assessment provides the desired data. The assessment must be tooled and designed to provide the right kind of data. You can't use a test given in April, results the following November, to really measure growth of an individual student, and you shouldn't try to apply that to that type of test. As I said, assessments are most effective if they are authentic and they guide instructional decision-making. And all assessments need to be part of an integrated longitudinal system, that the assessments take into account the developmental levels of children and that they follow children throughout the system, that at every point along the continuum of learning, we're gathering the data. And as I said, that all assessments need to be correlated to benchmarks or specific content standards, so we know what we're measuring. We have this belief in Stillwater that what gets measured gets done. So if we are measuring reading comprehension, we know that teachers and staff are going to be putting efforts into making sure that reading comprehension improves. So we feel it's very important to collect a lot of data and to measure. I'm going to talk about classroom level assessments, and Mr. Chairman, you mentioned formative and summative, and we talk about formative as assessment for learning. This tells, in terms of formative, this is measurement along the way, along the path, and it occurs in many cases on a daily basis. And this tells the teacher what type of learning is occurring at that moment, and they can adjust their instruction accordingly. The other type is summative, and the MCA test, would be a summative assessment. This tells us at the end of the day what learning took place. Talk about some of the assessments that occur in classrooms. Most of us haven't been in classrooms for quite a while, but we're all familiar with teacher-derived quizzes and tests that occur at the end of a unit, for example. Also, there are diagnostic probes that the teachers use. They may have created their own. They may have come from a company. But they look at literacy progress and math progress. And so a teacher may deliver a probe to a student maybe every week to see, are they growing on certain skills? Another big thing we're working on in Stillwater called end-of-course exams. actually with the NWEA organization. We're doing some pilot work with that company, developing end-of-course exams, which are tied directly to our state standards. We write the test items as a district, and these test items are then delivered through their computer system. And I will back up and say also, I'll come to another point. Observation of students is another valid form of observation. A teacher interacting with a student, observing their response, their understanding, their level of cognition is a really important type of assessment that goes on the fly, moment by moment. We also have portfolios and performance assessments. Not all data can be gathered on a true-false or a selected response type of test, so we do give performance-type exams where students really demonstrate and show what they've learned. Homework is another type of assessment that informs the teacher what learnings the student has mastered and has carried through and generalized. Interviews and consultation, interviewing parents, interviewing other staff members, and consulting is another type of informal assessment. Now, the purposes for all of these assessments, really, it really tells the teacher what type of student growth is occurring, and it indicates how they're marching towards mastery of specific standards. It helps in flexible grouping within the classroom. If you have real-time data on students and you know how they're performing, you can group students flexibly to address their skill needs. And frequent assessment allows you to group students effectively. Again, authentic and timely. These classroom assessments are occurring daily, weekly, monthly, which are authentic and helps the teacher deliver high-quality instruction. And this point kind of illustrates that. It also informs parents of progress. These types of classroom assessments, we, in many of our cases, send home data weekly to parents on progress on skills and standards, so it really informs the parent. It's also motivational for students. These types of assessments, students want to do well. They want to perform for their teachers on these types of exams. Many students tell us that they're not motivated to perform on state-level assessments. It's not important to them. But these classroom assessments are very important to our students. And it tells the teacher how effective they are at their teaching and how effective their strategies were. So teachers take this data, find new curriculum, new strategies to try to improve the performance of students. And I want to move on and talk a little bit about district assessments. Some has been talked about the Northwest Evaluation Association measures of academic progress, and Stillwater, this is our sixth year using MAP assessments. We were one of the first districts to use it, so we're pretty deep into it. Students are assessed on these measures at least twice a year, and in many cases, three times a year. That data is fed back to teachers the next day. They can group their students and use that data. We also use progress monitoring and repeated measures assessments in reading and math. This goes beyond the three times a year assessment from NWEA, and we have reading and math assessments that we have designed within our district and some other things that we use from other companies, where students, particularly at-risk students, are assessed weekly on their reading fluency, reading comprehension, and some of their mathematics skills, although the technology in math assessment isn't quite as far along as reading. So those students are tested weekly, the data is graphed and posted, and sent home to parents. And we collect that data at a district level, and we can then look at trends and how effective some of our supplemental and remedial programs are for students. Another thing we're doing at the district level is developing common end-of-course exams, semester exams, and unit exams. For example, in algebra, we teach algebra at the junior high level and the high school. The students, no matter what grade level they're in or school, they'll get the same exam, the same unit exam, the same end-of-course exam that is tied directly to the standards. Our teachers write those items. They're high-quality items that are low in error. And then we know exactly when a student takes a unit exam what reteaching needs to take place for a student across the district. And then we can collect that data district-wide. This is really an in-development type of endeavor we're doing, but the payoff is going to be huge for us. Math aptitude tests. We give math aptitude tests at various levels. These are national tests so we can place kids in the proper math classes across our district. The plan, Explore, PSAT, and AccuPlacer are tests that we use for post-secondary options and information for students and families. Again, some of the big purposes are it tells us as a district what type of longitudinal growth is happening, either in grade level cohorts, individual students. We can look at classroom level and building level growth using these assessments. We make placement decisions as well. And we're moving towards a system where we use these data for placement decisions within special education as well, often called response to intervention. And we're moving forward in Stillwater with using these data to make good decisions for kids. Again, informing parents of progress. We use our district-level data, MWA, for example. Every time a student takes a test through that system, parent report is generated, and that is sent home. Curriculum planning, the data we look at as a district from these assessments can tell us what's working within our curriculum and what is not. We can look at building level progress, as I mentioned, district level progress. Helps us with resource allocation. If we find that certain groups of kids in certain buildings aren't performing as well, we can allocate some resources in that direction. And as I noted, post-secondary planning. State level assessments. Most of us are familiar with these. We have the MCA2s, the grad tests, which will now be embedded in the MCA2s, as Dr. Heisted mentioned, the BST, the T, the MnSOLM, the TEALS, the MTEL, and the NAEP. The T, the MnSOLM, the TEALS, and the MTEL are for our ELL students, limited English proficient, and the NAEP is the National Assessment of Educational Progress.
Members, there will be a test at the end of the hearing, so commit these to memory.
Yes. It's a lot. And in my first year in the position, it's overwhelming just learning the acronyms. So there are many, many state-level assessments. And the MTAS, which is an alternate assessment for our students with severe disabilities. The purposes are system accountability, meeting federal mandates, meeting state mandates, and the state school report cards. Those are the main purposes and outcomes for those tests. And so the state generates these tests, and we then deliver them in the district. I would say that at the state level, you know, we have great support from our state level program in the Department of Assessment at the state level, and they really help us do a great job of delivering these assessments out in the schools. Some important summary points after Assessment 101 here is that most effective assessments for improving individual student learning are those authentic classroom-based assessments and some of those important district-level assessments that I talked about. State-level assessments are not effective for improving students' learning and skills, and they should not be used in that endeavor. As I said, don't try to make an assessment tool do something it was not designed to do. Use the proper tool for the job. And for assessment information to be useful, I haven't mentioned this, but teachers must have access to the data in an efficient and timely manner, and in a format that they can use to inform their teaching strategies. And that's the end of my formal presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Bailo. And I'm going to do this because I want to make sure we get the testimony in, and then I'll have the three remaining testifiers sit up there together for questions. So I'm going to hold off questions for you for a second.
Yes.
Or for a few minutes anyway. But thank you for a very concise presentation. Greatly appreciate it. Becky Schrader, I'm told that I pronounced your last name incorrectly, and so welcome. And is Dr. Rick Spikutsa also part of this presentation? Is that correct? Or okay, we have 25 minutes, so please keep that in mind. Welcome, Ms. Schrader, to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Becky Schrader, Director of Curriculum Instruction from the South Washington County School District, and we serve the communities of Woodbury, Cottage Grove, St. Paul Park, and Newport. I'm going to have you for a minute think about why we're all here. Why are we talking about education? It's about the students. I think the farther we get away from the kids and the schools, we forget what are these students going through in the short amount of time that they have, at least in our school district. Instructional time, testing takes up a lot of time. So bear with me as we go through a hypothetical student named Sarah and what she does during a school day and throughout the school year, learning and taking tests. Through Sarah's story, we're going to ask, are we testing too much? We have federal requirements, tests that district indicators, not student indicators. State requirements, also tests that don't help quickly determine how Sarah is doing. Think about the student. Local requirements, the tests that really help us track the individual students. But then when do we say? Are these tests making a difference in Sarah's learning? Thank you. Through Sarah's story, we ask. Think of these questions. Sarah's a seventh grader this year, fall of 2006. She's an average student in our school district. She's experienced 7 years in the district, and she has 6 more years until she graduates from high school. Let's look at her experiences with testing and the impact that has had on her teachers and her classroom performance. When Sarah was in kindergarten through second grade, there was minimal testing. In kindergarten through second grade, she's taking a couple of reading assessments. She also takes the Otis Lennon, an ability indicator, in second grade. The developmental reading assessment and the qualitative reading inventory, which continues on. She participates in those assessments. As a third grader, Sarah will take the MCA for reading and math. But now Sarah and her parents don't receive the results until the fall when she's in fourth grade. Parents receive the results. The results were located, reported in the media. District results are presented to school boards. You see the ranking of school districts, as Dr. Heistad said. Let's go back to Sarah, though. As a fifth grader, then Sarah takes the MCA in reading, math, and writing. Results come back in the fall of sixth grade. Also, Sarah participates in the math testing. In our district, this replaced the Iowa Test of Basic Skills. There was no sense in giving two assessments that measured the same thing. Math tests are taken in the fall and spring. Schools in our district have the option to administer testing in the winter to see if students are making growth or if instructional strategies need to be changed in the classroom. Her results are available immediately. Immediately, the teacher can take the results of Sarah's test and alter instruction. If there are 30 to 35 students in the teacher's classroom, they can look and say, where is Sarah at? What do I need to be changing? How do I need to differentiate my curriculum? What changes do I need to make sure that Sarah is being challenged? Or what changes do I need to make sure that Sarah is getting the assistance she needs? Then in the spring of sixth grade, Sarah takes math and reading. Sarah's teachers. Sarah has now taken local and state tests in both reading and math. Over the years, the teachers are stopping their instruction in order to administer the assessments. We realize our school day is short enough. We realize and acknowledge our school year is short enough. And as the standards change, districts, urban, suburban school districts, we look at our curriculum, we align our curriculum with the standards. That is constantly changing. The teachers are running to keep up to make sure that our curriculum is aligned with state standards. When the testing comes, there is testing at the federal, state, and the local level. And we do stop the instruction. Starting next year, we know with the MCAs, those will be given over 2 days. Our district has chosen to give them over 1 day this year. Next year, it will be 2 days. That's another day of non-instructional time. Let's think of Sarah. We know the testing, the results of the tests are good, but let's go back to Sarah. Sarah's now in seventh grade as we started out. She'll take the MAP in September and May. Sarah's school uses the MAP results, targets instruction to meet Sarah's need as a student. Sarah will take the MCA in reading and math in April. Her seventh grade scores will be available when she's in eighth grade. So when Sarah's an eighth grader, will her eighth grade teachers look at those eighth grade scores, or will they look at her scores from math right away that are there the next day? Sarah's an eighth grader. She takes the Explore test. Dr. Bailo and Dr. Heisted spoke to other assessments or other tests that are given to students. In our district field, there are other tests that are important and help with learning and guide students towards placement, future placement. The results of this are used for early career course placement and planning. They can help predict college readiness. The more information we have on a student, the better. Sarah participates in the MAP again in the spring and the fall, the MCA 2 in reading and math in April, and then now we do have our science tests. The online, as of now, MCA 2 science tests. Sarah will participate in those. Sarah becomes a ninth grader. Her MCA 2 scores are released in the fall of ninth grade. You see the pattern here that's being repeated. She participates in the MAP fall and spring. And this year, there is no MCA 2, but she does take the grad test of written composition to assess her writing skills. Sarah must pass this writing assessment in order for her to graduate and earn a high school diploma. Sarah is now a 10th grader. She takes the plan. This is another piece of information that will help indicate and predict college readiness. We want to prepare our kids for the future. We want to make sure the courses they are taking are appropriate and rigorous enough for them to be competitive in the world economy. As a 10th grader, she will take the MCA 2 in reading in April. She must pass this to graduate from high school. As an 11th grader, Sarah may need to retake the MCA 2 in reading. She also takes the MCA 2 in math and must pass this in order to graduate next year. All right, she's an 11th grader. What do we do if she does not pass? She's a senior. We must think about the possibilities of the numbers of students in our school districts across Minnesota that might not be proficient in math. And are we going to have graduates the same amount proficient that we have now? And if not, what are we going to provide for them curriculum-wise and instruction-wise? Sarah must also take the MCA 2 in science. This is part of the federal AYP requirement, not necessarily a proficiency for a high school diploma now. As a 12th grader, Sarah has met all the testing requirements in reading, writing, and math. She's met or exceeded the number of course credits to earn a high school diploma, depending on the school district she's at, how many credits she must earn to graduate. She earns her diploma. Sarah really is an average student. Her story is simple. There are many more students, as we know, in urban and suburban school districts that have more of a complex story. We have our gifted and talented students. Are they being challenged? Are we making sure that the rigorous material is available for them? Special education, are we meeting the needs of our special education students, or are we over-testing and testing with our special education students? English language learners. We saw the list that Dr. Bailo presented of all the ELL assessments that students need to participate. And then other students receive a variety of targeted services. But like I said, Sarah does have one, has a simple story being an average student. How do we plan for Sarah's success? If we look at the student, we look at the whole child. Testing is only one part of it. Is Sarah getting the education she needs to succeed? Regular feedback on Sarah's status and informal assessments really help guide her instruction. It's the teachers that are teaching Sarah. Progress is evident through local tests. Federal and state tests do give us information. They report on schools. They report on school districts. But they don't keep up with Sarah's instructional needs. And remember, it's about Sarah and it's about the kids in our schools. In closing, through Sarah's story, not only all the number of tests she's taking, but think, are the tests she's taking impacting her learning? And I will just leave you with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schrader. I really appreciate you putting a personal human face on this and the question of where, let's go back to Sarah, and very concisely laying out a picture of the tension between our state and federal summative test approaches versus our local formative assessments, as well as issues about real-time feedback. I think what Dr. Bailo spoke earlier referred to as authentic authenticity, the issue of the frequency of tests, and also you mentioned briefly the changing standards. So we've gone through this period of time where I think we've been throwing a lot of things out of school districts and schools, and have changed up our expectations in a pretty often in a very short period of time, to some degree keeping schools off balance and school districts off balance. So I think you did a great job of really concisely putting together issues that we're painfully aware of, and hopefully we'll find a way to find a way to merge a bunch of different needs that we have, Sarah's needs as well as our big picture needs. I'm going to hold off questions again because I want to make sure that Dr. Spikuza,
you got it right.
Spikuza, welcome. Please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you and good morning. Truly appreciate the privilege and honor to be here this morning and speak on behalf of South Washington County Schools. My name is Dr. Rick Spikuza, and I've had an interesting career in that I've worked in both urban educational settings in St. Paul and Minneapolis. I recently had worked for 3.5 years in the Mounds View Public Schools, now currently have taken a position with the South Washington County Schools as of January. One of the things that you may be sitting there asking is, as we told the story of Sarah or Harold going through their academic career and being tested, is if the state's already providing you with a nice assessment that covers multiple grades, why are you districts adding so many more additional NALTs and all those additional assessments that you saw? And I think if you go back to the purpose that we're talking about with learning, is that there's a professor at the University of Minnesota and also at Penn State, Jim Eiseldyke and Bob Aglesine, who've written a book on assessment. And it's one of the most used assessment books in the country. And the purpose of assessment, they articulate, is the gathering of information to answer a specific question and then to evaluate and make a judgment for a student. And I think that once you start to look at the types of judgments and expectations that we have on students, every one of these measures has a certain purpose and perspective that helps students in a formative way, early indicator way, and then in a summative way. And one of the mandates we have as meeting No Child Left Behind, a federal mandate at the state level, is that we must, one, articulate standards as a community that included the business community, the legislature, our parents, our teachers, to start to say, what do we expect of our students that are going through our public education schools, and what do we expect at every single grade, 3 through 8, and then in high school. We also have to do that in reading and mathematics. And so as we start to articulate those standards, we're then mandated to have an assessment in place, an assessment at a state level in which all students take the same test to the same standard and then be able to report out the percent of our students that are proficient. The good news is by 2014, 100% of all our students in the state of Minnesota will be above that standard. If they're not, we haven't met No Child Left Behind. And I think that's the challenge. And so one of the suggestions I would make is you sit and start to talk about funding, the allocation of the assessments that are in place, pursuing the value-added system that's been mandated and in legislation already. And I want to remind you that there's a MDE-sponsored workshop on value-added later this month. I believe it's February 23rd. And I would encourage participation or designees to be there, because the definition and how you articulate value-added is different depending on who is in the room and how it's being used. Beyond nation-leading, toward world-leading and world-competing. Those were some of the words of the State of the State address. And it was an interesting presentation because it first acknowledged that the students in the state of Minnesota, based on previous assessments, either on the National Assessment of Educational Progress or with regards to our ACT scores, Minnesota students continue to rank at the top or number one in the country compared to other students in the state. But we must acknowledge, if you reference books or the writer from the New York Times, Thomas Friedman, and know, understand the world is flat, we're not just preparing students for the current environment, but we're preparing them for the future, to be competitive in a world market where they're going to be challenged and competing for jobs across this globe. And so one of the things I think we need to do is first acknowledge that we do have some very high standards in place, that we have some very good educational practices, Having worked in urban and suburban districts, I can tell you I'd be very proud to have my child in many classrooms across the state. We have to have adequate methods of reporting. Currently, one of the things that we do, like many other institutions, is we report out, to make it very simplistic, is we give stars. And there's a five-star system in which we give report cards to clearly translate the information that tends to be quite complex across grades and across tests and across standards so that the community, the families, can decide, is this school of quality and is that where I want to enroll my child? And if it's not of quality, we see the stars go down and I can start to decide whether or not I want to move my child or force and leverage certain resources to reconstitute a school. The challenge, however, is 2 plus 2 is not 4, and I'm not talking about new math. But we've talked about maybe putting funding on the stars. And one of the things that we have to identify is that, yes, the federal mandate is that we have Title I tests, standards, and push those forward. The report card is a state response about how we want to purport or report back to the community, our constituents, to the business community, to teachers, and to families about how their students, Sarah, Harold, are performing. The challenge is that since the MCAs have been in place, the business rules have never been the same with regards to how stars are allocated. In fact, did you know that last year, ELL students, students for whom English is not their first language, did not participate in the MCA readings across the state. Rather, they took a different test, the test of emerging academic English. Based on a federal interpretation of that test and how that test was aligned to the old profile, MDE was told that they must now include ELL students in the MCA reading test. That means every district, depending on the proportion of students who are new to the country or who are not English speakers, now will have the report card including students in different proportions on their report card. In addition, special education students previously had taken a test that was a rubric where the special ed case manager would fill out reading proficiency, math proficiency on a 1-5 scale. The federal government again said that is not a quality assessment with regards to measuring students' performance, and they created the MTES, the Minnesota Test of Academic Skills. This changes the nature of the assessment. No longer will special education staff be filling out whether or not a student is making progress on their individual educational plans, another federal mandate, but rather they now must work one-on-one with the student in the month of April around very specific 10 activities in reading and mathematics, again for the most severe and cognitively disabled, and then rate those performances and put that forward. Why do I say 2 plus 2 is not 4? Because the stars are awarded to a school and you are capped at 3. In fact, you are capped at 2 if you do not make adequate yearly progress for any of the reporting groups. No Child Left Behind mandates that we now must disaggregate our information at a state, district, and school level by the 5 racial ethnic groups that are federally categorized, all students. Then we have 2 instructional programs, special education and ELL. And then we have a proxy for poverty through free and reduced lunch. You now have 9 categories of students for whom we're going to report performance on the MCA scores. Historically, the test for special education and ELL students has changed across years, and yet we're going to report the same 5-star system out to the community. In addition, think of those 9 cells as light switches. The report card is based on whether or not 40 students in any one of those 9 categories is enrolled at your school across the grades participating. If I have 40 students who are ELL, 40 students who are in special education, 40 students in any of the 5 racial ethnic groups, that light goes on. As soon as I have 40 students, 38 of those students must be there the day of the test and the makeup day. If 37 test, I'm automatically a school that's identified as failing to make AYP. It has no regard to the proficiency and performance of the students. It doesn't matter if I'm a high school of 2,000, or 150, but out of 40 students, if we fall below 38, I'm automatically capped at 2 stars. To put funding based on whether or not that school or that district has made its requirement I would say should be gone, should be considered with great caution. Showing student gains over the proposed value-added system. Beginning with documentation growth, many districts have advocated for the NWA. You saw that Minneapolis, Stillwater, Moundsview, Wayzata, South Washington County, 50%, I believe, of all students in the state, not 50% of the districts, but 50% of the students are participating in the NWA system. There's a good proportion of our students for whom teachers and families expect the ability for us to look at growth over time. The challenge is, however, value-added goes beyond that. And value-added talks about that we can articulate the impact of the district, a teacher, or a school on the growth across time. The challenge for us, however, is that what do we do when high schools, where we're going to appropriate potentially $75 million, or start to talk about the 3R schools, cannot participate in that value-added system? And why can't they? Because the scale on the MCAs that MDE has built is only being adjusted to look at growth 3 to 4, 4 to 5, 5 to 6 at the next adjacent grade. There is no adjacent grade tested at 10th grade reading and 11th grade math. That means for high schools, they will not participate in the current articulation of the value-added system that's in place. And I wanted also to mention that two of my colleagues talked a little bit about the VST sunsetting and the move to the grad test embedded in the MCAs. Please make sure that you understand that that currently is not in legislation. That is a proposal by MDE to make sure that as the VST goes away, that the grad is part of the MCAs. Currently, to get a diploma, a student at 10th and 11th grade must be proficient on those tests. A test that last year changed to the MCA 2, the new standard, where 30% of the students currently in 12th grade were proficient on that 11th grade math test. The previous year, under the old MCAs, the previous standard, 70% of our students were proficient. The question isn't whether or not high schools imploded between 205 and 206, but rather how are we ramping up to the new world-challenging standards that we want all students to be in place. Online by 209. It's a mantra that MDE has been put forth, and it's a very appropriate mantra with regards to the ability for us to access student test scores instantly after they test, to be able to have a writing sample that could actually be ported back to a district so that a language arts teacher, could actually see the writing samples of students juxtaposed immediately with the rubric that was applied. Many of our parents currently are accessing online report cards. They can see attendance. They can fund their lunch balances. How important would it be if we could start to have more technology in the schools to be able to assess students on a more frequent basis? The challenge here, however, is that it's not completely funded. And I am a parent of a student that's in a college here at the University of Minnesota, so I know as a parent of being requested, like a mosquito, I need more money, I need more money. That's a challenge. As a parent, I understand that. As a legislature, I would encourage you to understand, however, as you start to appropriate more funds for technology at MDE and even at the legislature, schools have been underfunded with regards to the move toward technology. It takes a computer to be able to assess a student on online assessments. It takes somebody that's knowledgeable. If you start to talk about servers, connectivity, virus protection, and those are the challenges that is different in the skill and type of employee that school systems will hire. Before I could take a box, and I can schlep that 50-pound box, and I can deal those paper pencil tests like dealers at the cards, I can test everybody in one sitting, and I can collect those tests and send them back for scanning. I can't do that with a laptop. And so the challenge for us is that we need personnel that are able to run these computers. We need funds to be able to purchase the computers. And unlike the business community, we can't write that off after 5 years of depreciation and then build more widgets to access new technology. And so I would encourage you to consider funding either positions for staff to be able to have well-trained technicians on site, but also the computers are in place.
Mr. Spicosa, I'm going to interrupt just very quickly because we're unfortunately running out of time, and I'm learning quite a bit from your presentation. So we regret that. I need to let you know that to kind of speed it up and really zero in on your remaining major points for us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman. I would like to just point to the last bullet here on the MBA report cards and the STAR system. X-STAR system is our state's report card. And currently it is not, it does not have direct representation within NDE of the individuals that are creating the test and are most knowledgeable about the scale. And I would encourage that there be a partnership between the current No Child Left Behind department within NDE and the assessment department. Those two departments need to work together to have an appropriate report card. In addition, I would encourage that the business community, stakeholders, and families get to sit at that table so the report card truly is something that they can use as a consumer. The value added I just want to bring to your attention is that it does not mean the same thing to everybody, and that currently it is not being identified as just gain. And I would encourage us that we could at least start with what percent of our students went from deficient to partial, from partial to mastery, and from mastery to exceeding. And that would be a very good first step that's already in place and would be very transparent to our community. And so I appreciate your time, your patience, and attention to these educational matters. Thank you.
Mr. Spicoza, thank you so much. We're right up at our, unfortunately, our adjourning time. I do apologize. There were a number of members who had questions. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you, Ms. Schrader. Thank you, Dr. Bailo and Dr. Heistad. And we are adjourned until next week.